Strengthen your immune system with Goldman Laboratories liposomal vitamin C and get 10% off. Quote 10 off at goldmanlaboratories.com.
Hello and welcome to the Yes Live Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, regular presenter of the show and founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that supports people with cancer by helping them to understand and use integrative medicine to improve their well-being, their outcomes and their longevity. The show's been running for more than 5 years now, and there are over 300 past editions you can search through on the Yes to Life website. That's yestolife.org.uk. But nonetheless, today's show is a first, in as much as my guest is a pharmacist, a discipline I've not included so far in the show. And I'm really looking forward to finding out what particular angles and insights Charlotte Lucas will be able to bring to the debate on integration in cancer care. Hi Charlotte, a big welcome to the Yes Life Show.
Hi Robin, thank you very much. I'm very honoured, flattered that you have invited me on. I'm very much looking forward to our chat.
Excellent, me too. So we've heard quite a bit recently about the British Society for Integrative Oncology on the Yes Life Show and the online show that they're putting on with Progressive Communications next month, 15th of May, Integrative Oncology UK 2021. So the BSIO is experiencing a startling resurgence of support and interest from professionals this year, which is great. And it's through this that I've been fortunate to be introduced to you. So we've had all sorts of stories of people picking up the banner for integrative medicine in some form, often for personal reasons, you know, commonly leaving behind a corporate career to pursue training in nutrition as a result of a personal experience of cancer. Your story is sort of along these lines, but with another twist. Can you start by telling us about your early training and what took you in that direction?
So I decided to go to university to study pharmacy. I have been a pharmacist within the NHS in various sort of guises for the majority of my career. So I went to university to study pharmacy, and then unfortunately life took a little bit of a turn, and in my final year at university both my father and my uncle died within 3 months of each other through sort of massive cerebral hemorrhages or strokes. Exactly the same part of the brain, and once they'd collapsed they never regained consciousness and passed away. And it was a massive life-changing event for me, probably also because my mother descended into alcoholism, which unfortunately lasted for 25 years. So I felt like the carpet had been pulled from under me, and I just clung on to my pharmacy as the only solid thing in my life, kind of taking me forward, but didn't really actually focus on where that was taking me, other than I was in healthcare. I wanted to be in healthcare because I wanted to actually try to do good and prevent these tragic things from happening to other families. And that was kind of my driver. Ironically, my mother was a clinical psychologist. So we'd been brought up in a family that had been who had looked at health in very broad terms, and so the one thing I always found with pharmacy is it was incredibly narrow, because that's the way we tend to view disease in this country, in quite a narrow way, and try and find a pathway which is associated with a disease and try and sort of fix that pathway using a pharmaceutical preparation. So I was slightly in conflict, but didn't quite know why. And I carried on my kind of career. I did actually start to recover from this sort of initial tragedy. And then we got knocked I was with my now husband, then boyfriend, and his mother died 2 years after my father of cancer. Mm. And then 8 months after that, his father collapsed from a stroke. So we had a really, really rough ride as a couple. And I just about survived and was trying to cling on to, you know, my career is the solid thing going forward. And it was in my late 20s that I went back to university, and I did another year kind of trying to use my brain a bit more effectively. And I wanted to be a bit more integrative in what I was doing. So it was a postgraduate diploma. It was new in community pharmacy, and it was basically looking at how to broaden the role of a pharmacist within the community. And I had to work more collaboratively with GPs and that sort of thing. And which was great. It took me into prescribing advising, and it took me on lots of different sort of journeys. And I got a much better overview of the whole primary care offer for us as residents of the UK. But I'm still frustrated by some of the holes and some of the poor communication, interdisciplinary communication that existed. And then roll forward, I settled, had children, and about 10 years ago, I started to get really frustrated because I was actually sort of focusing on trying to support individuals with medicines use. So we have a problem in this country with something called polypharmacy, which means that because of the structure of prescribing guidance through NICE,
right,
often patients will go to the GP and they will present with a condition. It might be raised blood pressure or a cholesterol result that's not quite great. And apart from a little couple of sentences on the NICE guidance, which says offer diet and lifestyle advice, the next thing is to offer a type of blood pressure lowering or cholesterol lowering drug. And often that top bit gets missed because within the primary care team, we're not trained to actually offer that.
No, we have very little resources. Right.
There's no one there to deliver. So we go straight to, let's pop in the drugs. So my role towards the sort of end of my time in community pharmacy was looking and supporting people with these kind of lots of drugs that weren't necessarily necessary, for want of a better word. And I grew more and more and more frustrated because I was thinking, this is just crazy. Because every drug has side effects, and everyone responds very differently to different medications for various reasons. And it becomes a very complex picture when someone's sitting in front of you and they're on five or six medicines. Probably half of those are to counter the side effects of the first three medicines. And I just thought, this is crazy. But I wasn't equipped. The Public Health England information was a little incoherent. I was getting bombarded, as the whole population are, by conflicting faddy messages about diet and lifestyle. And I mean, how, if I couldn't unpick what the best was out of it, how on earth was somebody who wasn't in healthcare going to be able to unpick it? So I took a decision to actually leave my role in pharmacy, and I've started to actually look into nutrition. I'm a real foodie anyway. We grow a lot of vegetables. It's always been, I get a lot of comfort, as I'm sure a lot of people do, from food. It is my relaxation, it is my creativity, it has a great meaning to me. But I also am fully aware of its health giving properties. And I thought, well, nutrition, I've got to study nutrition. And it was a real visceral pull. I had to go and do this. And so roll forward a few years, and I'm just coming to the end of my MSc in nutritional medicine, which has been absolutely game-changing, life-changing, and has spurred me on to hopefully encourage far more provision in the country, from far more support But not just nutrition, that I studied nutrition, but it has its tentacles in everything to do with lifestyle. So sleep, exercise, stress management, just looking at the way we live in the West. And it's been a fantastic experience. And for now, I want to kind of go forward and utilize that. But there's no sort of role within, unfortunately, within the NHS to do that. So sort of backtracking a bit, because I know this is about cancer. I never went into this with a focus on where I would end up. In fact, a lot of my friends used to think I was a bit crazy. Oh, what are you doing? There's not necessarily any job for you at the end of it. What are you doing? You know, this is, what are you going to do when you come out? And I said, I don't know. I just know I've got to start. And my hope, my dream is that this, you know, will be a provision across the country for everybody. But in this, as we transition through, and I think it is a reasonable dream. It'll take a while, but I think it is a reasonable dream. I was in, I was looking after people who were suffering from chronic disease. So they were the things that you would associate with community prescribing. So the autoimmune diseases, cardiovascular diseases, type 2 diabetes, the things that are managed very well in community. And that's my background. I've worked in diabetes prevention. That is my background. But with all of that sort of knowledge and experience, there was nowhere, or there is nowhere actually within the NHS for me to go. And then I started thinking, I don't want to just necessarily see this as nutrition, because it's not all about nutrition, it's wider. And I embarked on the training with the Institute of Functional Medicine. And it's through the Institute of Functional Medicine and doing some work for the Doctor's Kitchen that I got in touch with Professor Robert Thomas, who is a leading oncologist and a real advocate for diet, and particularly focuses on nutrition within his care. Luckily for me, he happens to be our local oncologist, which is very... Yeah, it's very, very lucky for me. And so, and through that, I think that was just fantastic. I found a real local mentor, absolutely superb. But I also got involved in a local clinic. So we have an amazing lady who decided that the provision at Milton Keynes Hospital wasn't good enough for the cancer patients with regards to wigs. So she's a hairdresser who takes real interest in her clients, and a lot of clients coming who were going through chemotherapy and radiotherapy, and she felt that she could offer a better service. So she negotiated with the hospital, and she ended up taking on the wig service for on behalf of the hospital, and then it grew into this clinic for all types of hair loss. But there are lots of patients who are going through treatment for cancer that come into that clinic, and we got chatting, and I ended up getting involved, and I now help out at that clinic. So it's my first real experience with patients going through cancer treatment, and it's been an absolute delight, pleasure to be able to offer some services and offer some support.
I imagine
individualized support, which I think is really key to these patients. So,
okay, can I just go back over a couple of things you've been talking about? All sorts of massively interesting stuff there. The first things I wanted to just talk a little bit more about the problems that we have around polypharmacy, and I'm not sure that everybody appreciates this fact that actually the complications that are inherent in people taking 5-6 different drugs, that each of which has side effects. Even the ones that are taken to deal with the side effects of the first ones, they've got their own side effects. And in the end, sorting out what is the disease and what are the side effects must become an almost impossible puzzle. And, you know, people just don't bother and just leave it alone, I imagine. I just don't know what happens. But maybe could you just say a little bit more about, you know, that I think it's an incredibly common problem that we're still dealing with in all the population who are over 75, you know, pretty much. Is that true?
Absolutely. And you're, you know, a very astute observation. It is a real problem in this country because it's very hard to actually deal with. And it takes time. And as we know, within the NHS, there's a lack of patient practitioner time to actually resolve this. And so it becomes just the norm for people to be on drugs. And I think if you were to actually sort of do a bit of a kind of survey in the population, which I sort of do, but it's not official in any capacity. I will speak to, so I'm in my 50s now. I will speak to friends and colleagues and ask, and there is a kind of acceptance that, oh, if you get into your 50s, you know, it's normal. You've got high blood pressure. It's normal to be on a blood pressure lowering drug. I know you've got a sort of slightly imbalanced lipid. So it's okay to be on a statin. I'm thinking, where does this idea that it's okay to be on these medicines come from?
Yeah.
And we've normalized this sort of process.
Yeah,
because that's what happens, and that's what happens if you have this kind of standardized algorithmic prescribing, and no one's ever addressing the root cause. There's never any focus on, let's look at the root cause, let's try and work out why this is going on. It would be very easy to adjust somebody's sort of cholesterol and blood pressure using diet and lifestyle if there was time put in to work with a client. Everybody's different. Everybody has different reasons why things might be raised. But just having family history doesn't mean you are going to have these degenerative conditions. They're driven by diet and lifestyle, and they are very fixable. And I feel like I want to kind of go out there and sort of empower people and say, you have the tools. The tools are there. This is not, you know, a foregone conclusion. This is not the route out. These are sticking plaster approaches. They're not treating the underlying problem.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I think this is where medicine's been collaborating with industry, maybe unwittingly, but it's been doing it for far too long. Is, of course, this kind of way of treating people, it actually supports crap food, which the industry can carry on making food, which makes a lot of money and makes people sick. And it also supports a massive industry making all those pills that are being dealt out to everybody over 50. You know, it's just like an extraordinary business opportunity for two vast industries. And none of it is for our benefit. It's just to feed off us and make money out of us. So your message needs to be heard loud and clear. So I hope you'll be shouting it from the mountaintops.
Well, yeah, I hope so. I think you make a really good point there. And there are, you know, people like Rupi, who's running the Doctor's Kitchen. He's out there shouting and trying to drive the education. Because when we go to university to study things like pharmacy or nursing or medicine, we don't get nutrition and lifestyle training. It's nuts, completely crazy. And I think partly, you touch on a really good point, and I think partly it's driven by the way we view science and research. Mm. It is really, really difficult to apply the same research methodology to food that you apply to pharmaceuticals. So the way the drug industry sort of does its research, it goes back to that identifying a pathway of something that is malfunctioning and trying to fix that pathway using one chemical to try and block an enzyme or promote an enzyme or slightly change sort of genetic expression or something along those lines. Whereas food, if you try and study food, an apple is a kind of really complex sort of set of all different types of chemicals. It isn't just one thing. So studying food is complex. Mm-hmm. And so what you end up getting is a kind of halfway house. You get a kind of, oh, let's try and identify what's good in that food.
Yeah,
and then let's drill it down. So yeah. I'll give you turmeric, for example.
Yeah.
Turmeric, we know that turmeric, through broader observational or epidemiological studies, is anti-inflammatory and healthful. It's a good thing to have for lots of different reasons. It's right. really rich in these things called polyphenols, which are brilliant for us. But the science then says, oh, well, let's try and find what it is in turmeric that's active. So they drill it down to one. Say turmeric has 120 polyphenols. They drill it down to one polyphenol. They look at curcumin. They study it. They work out how it works. And then it gets promoted as the thing that is the active ingredient, because they've studied that one. And then it gets packaged into a supplement, mm-hmm. and the supplement industry is a completely different thing as well, and it's quite unregulated, and I can talk about that a little bit as yeah. well. But it gets kind of formulated into a supplement, and then people take a supplement of, or encouraged to, it's marketed, it's promoted, the press get hold of it, people think, I've got to take curcumin. Missing the point that we studied this really because actually the overarching pattern showed us that turmeric was really useful. Mm. It goes back to the food. You should always go back to the whole food. And so trying to actually look at diet and lifestyle through the lens of a biomedical science approach is nuts.
Yeah,
you've got to have a better way of looking at the science.
Yeah, it's the wrong lens, that's right. I think I agree with that. And that's beginning to be realised, I think, and I think some other ideas are beginning to gain some traction at last. So, yeah, it's got to change. I agree with that.
Absolutely.
Something else I wanted to ask you about was I'm fascinated by the fact, well, normally the problem with diet and lifestyle is they're not even on the radar of an organisation like NICE, okay? It's like nowhere to be seen. Now, interestingly enough, you're saying it's the first line approach that's supposed to be employed by medics in many instances, and yet the NHS has no capability to deliver. So isn't our NHS actually falling far short of its brief in being able to deliver the recommendations of NICE in that case? Isn't there a case for kind of a legal challenge that why on earth doesn't have the NHS have the first line capability to deliver the best first approach to a particular condition?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I quite like that approach. I hadn't even thought about it like a legal challenge. Yes. So if, not that I've looked at them in the last year, but the NICE guidance, for example, for sort of hypertension or mild hypertension, the first line approach would be address diet and lifestyle. I don't know any GP surgeries that I'm in touch with that have the ability within that. They might have a sort of a few public health leaflets. I know through my immediate conversations with surgeries how it's done, right. and the people who are delivering are any of this advice. It is they're not trained.
Right.
It's not personalised. It's just leaflets. It's poor. So there's no. I don't understand. It's not stipulated within NICE how that should be delivered, and maybe right. that needs clarifying, but yeah. That is absolutely right. I totally concur with you, and my dream is that every primary care practice should have somebody available to deliver more personalized diet and lifestyle, exercise, all of those sorts of things first and foremost. It should be the approach.
Well,
there's no support.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We had Dr. David Unwin speaking at our recent Congress, and of course he's well known for exactly that, for actually bringing the approach of diet and lifestyle to diabetes and actually having extraordinary successes that no other GP surgery in the country could possibly match by just not doing drugs and doing this other stuff instead. So, you know, the power of what could be possible if GP surgeries took the NICE guidelines seriously is quite apparent from that alone, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, David Dunman's done some remarkable stuff. He's been the driver behind diabetes reversal. So if you catch type 2 diabetes relatively early, it's very easy to reverse it using diet and lifestyle approaches.
I know.
Very easy to prevent it using diet and lifestyle approaches. What the NHS is doing, and this is what I was working on last year, it's actually outsourcing it. So it's taking it away from the GP surgery, which I'm a little uncomfortable with because I think there's a connection with patients and their surgery. But it's a third-party provider providing diabetes prevention and diabetes reversal. So you would be referred by your GP practice to this third-party provider, and they would... in some case, some of them it is group sessions, some of it is more individualized, but you then go through a program which does talk about diet, does address a lot of it diet heavy, but it's also about sleep, it's about mindfulness, and it's about movement as well. And the people providing the sort of the service do have training. They will be to have some level in personal training qualification or some qualification within within nutrition. So they are people who are trained to deliver the service. But it's a third, it is slowly being rolled out over the country, but it's third party. It's not the GP's practice and it's not, not the GP's.
No, it would be far better if it was actually integrated into the GP practice, wouldn't it? Yeah, there's no doubt about that. There's so many things. I mean, in principle, it sounds fine to refer it outside, but practice tells us that things go wrong, actually, in these arrangements, and they, it's not in the patient's best interest in the end to have some business running, you know, sort of milking the system in that way and siphoning off patients. So anyway, interesting, interesting. So anyway, good to talk about that. So look, coming back to your trajectory, you were just saying how you've trained in nutrition and you've gone on to train in functional medicine now. So I want to do a little bit of compare and contrast between your training in pharmacy and your training in functional medicine. So these are two different beasts, but they're both about, you know, healthcare. Would you want to say a bit about the differences between the two trainings you had and maybe what they both bring to the table? Because you're unusual in as much as you're training both rather than having two separate people trying to work together. Maybe that's a good scenario to have a pharmacist working alongside somebody who understands functional medicine. That's a good combination. But you are actually, you know, two in one. And so what does this give you in the way of your view of things, if you like? I mean, you've already expressed quite strong views about the supplement industry, which come, I think, probably a lot from your pharmacy background. You're looking at the, you know, what's going on there. So do you want to say a bit more about that?
Right, that's a very interesting question. So I my pharmacy training was very much and I'm old as well, so my pharmacy training was quite some time ago. It has definitely got broader, the kind of ongoing, we have a very good body within pharmacy called the CPPE that continues to educate us, but again it's very drug disease mechanism focused when it at its root, but it's very, I think it's very disease focused, it's rather than health focused. And I think if you're going to get to the nub of my frustration, it's that we don't focus on maintaining and building healthy, resilient individuals. We focus on treating them when they are sick, and I think that is the kind of where I sort of started to get frustrated. So my pharmacy training was very much looking at drug body interactions. It was very less individualized. It was very much population approach, with some tweaks, obviously, if people are really struggling with a medicine. And it very, very little support with regard to any supplements. We were not trained on supplements. And I don't think even now there's very much training on looking at the interaction. Because, sorry, I'll backtrack a little bit. Drugs really can knock out sort of your nutritional sort of status. There are a lot of drugs that affect nutritional status and it's not dealt with. It's never, I'll give you an example, a highly sort of prescribed drug for type 2 diabetes is metformin. It's a standard preparation and it's done some, you know, it does have a very good sort of outcomes. It really does help. It reduces inflammation, it reduces sugar, and it definitely has benefits. And I'm not anti-drug at all. But if you take metformin for a long time, it can really knock out things like B12. And people, GPs, pharmacists, I wasn't aware of that. Even though that's my world, I really wasn't aware of the significance of that. So I think what my nutritional training has done is actually give me that link between how if we go down the drug route, that also has not only the side effects with regard to the drug that are measurable visually or by feeling or whatever, but there are biochemical issues that we really need to address that we've not been looking at with regard to nutrition. So that's kind of why the nutrition also came into my training. But it was very much diseased. Pharmacy is very much disease focused, mechanism focused, drug focused, not health focused. Whereas functional medicine is what I call my health home. It's very much looking at integrating health and looking at the systems rather than one organ. It looks at all of the systems. It looks at how everything is interrelated, everything is interconnected, and that and looks for the root cause. So it looks at person as a whole, their stress levels, their sort of the pressures in life, any triggers that might have kind of been at the root cause of a onset of an illness or a disease. And it very much focuses on the patient, the individual, and it's about working with that individual. It takes away that expert-patient sort of dynamic, and it's very much working on an equal basis where it's more like a coaching kind of approach, and it's very much more successful because you've got somebody, you understand somebody because you've had time to actually get to the underpinning causes. You work together to find the solutions, and it's much more holistic, supportive approach, and it's about promoting health and building health, not just focusing on disease.
So there's a phrase which was coined in the 1980s, would you believe, called patient-centered care, and the NHS has been talking about it ever since. You still can't see it yet anywhere, but they've got lots of jobs which are around patient-centered care. I noticed lots of people work in that field, but it still doesn't happen. But interesting enough, but would you describe functional medicine as actually being patient-centered care?
Oh, absolutely. Very, very much. That is it. It's at its nub. And if the NHS could take a little bit of that model and incorporate it into its practices, I think we'd have a much more promising future within the NHS.
So, interesting enough, so you talked a bit there about the drugs, and you gave a good example there of a drug which is frightfully useful. You know, it does a lot of good work for people, even used in the cancer field as well. And and it definitely has its uses, but as with every drug, it has its downsides. And the best that orthodox medicine seems to have offered up to now is that when you have some downsides, what do you do about it? Well, you get another drug. This is always the answer, to get another drug and bring some more downsides with that. Now, one of the increasingly obvious things that's coming out of true integration is the potential of bringing together two different approaches, one of which is health promoting and one of which is a drug with side effects, and how the two together can give far, far better results than one on its own. And, you know, there's an extraordinary synergy quite often just between two very simple things, you know, or introducing one nutrient into an otherwise utterly conventional approach to a disease. And this is very striking to me. I've talked to a lot of people about this, you know, people are doing research in this field and everything, and they are also extremely surprised by the success that can be achieved in this way. And it seems very much that the patient's best interests are fulfilled by having the whole panoply of all of these approaches on offer at the same time, and with people who understand how to work together, who understand the interactions are much greater than they may have previously thought, and that collaboration of expertise is the only way to care for people properly.
Absolutely, absolutely. I couldn't have said it better myself. I I'll give you an example. I was in 1993 when I was at King's doing my postgraduate year there. We were talking about the need for better interdisciplinary communication. And this was just between tradition. This is about traditional medical fields then. And it was always shocking, and it still is shocking. And that's not taking into consideration all the other lifestyle and dietary approaches we need. It's I mean, it's the nub of life, isn't it? Good communication is key. And to be able to actually have that sort of team approach to everything, I believe is the only way forward. It's a must.
Mm. Well, interestingly enough, I think there's a very strong connection between that and the subject we were just talking about, which is patient-centred care. Patient-centred care isn't possible because the lack of willingness to work as a team. Until that happens, you can't possibly really have patient-centred care, because, you know, to put them in the centre makes them more important than any of those specialists and their special disciplines, which they think are the only thing that's going to help. And it puts them in their place as being one of the resources that might help this person's sickness. So, all right. Look, one last thing to round off with. We're running out of time now, but I've got my own ideas about this, of course, but I'm interested to hear what you think with your experience and training in both worlds. So you'll be well aware by now the immense power of medicinal mushrooms to help people with cancer. And I'm taking this as simply one example rather than like you did with turmeric, but it is one of the starkest ones. So you might not be aware, but, or maybe you are, of the fact that back when I started Yesterlife, you know, some 15 years ago or so, there was a 700-page report from Cancer Research UK reviewing all the science behind medical mushrooms, almost entirely positive, the whole thing, of course, because there's lots of good science even back then. Since then, there's even more. Of course, it's only gone on getting better and more since. But you can't find that report now. It's disappeared from the internet. There's references to it, but it's gone. But, you know, in a world that makes sense, where good science is the driver of change in medicine, by now, mushrooms would be right there in mainstream medicine care alongside conventional treatments, as indeed they are in some countries. But, of course, well, tragically, in reality, the very idea of an oncologist doling out mushroom extracts is something like expecting a professional weightlifter to give a ballet performance. You know, it's that improbable in this country. So from your experience of the world of conventional medicine, how could such powerful resources be consistently kept away from people with cancer who are undergoing some of the most grueling treatments the patients are given and they're experiencing such poor outcomes?
It goes back to what I was talking about before, which is the way that the NICE review the data. So when you look at the science and you look at the hierarchy of research, it's a bit like a pyramid, and people look at the placebo-controlled randomized trial, or even something called a meta-analysis or systematic review of that, as being the pinnacle of scientific research. And then below that, the weight of that research is less. So if people want to actually pin a prescribing guidance on something, they're looking for that top tier of evidence. And because I haven't got the papers in front of me, and it's interesting you say they've disappeared, it's really hard for me to kind of be accurate in my sort of analysis of this. But I would imagine that the powers that be, and it might be something, it might be collaboration with the pharmaceutical industry, I don't know. I think the powers that be would say, well, we can't standardize the mushroom extracts in the way that we would standardize a drug. So the pharma industry will make a drug and it will be formulated and then tested. And it will have to have a certain window of bioavailability. So that's where the drug is taken in and then the drug gets kind of disseminated or spread throughout the body so that say 70% is available for use within the body, and it's made up of, I don't know, be probably different forms, but it would be able to measure those forms. Within an extract of mushrooms, there isn't a way of standardizing it. And I think that the powers that be will find that very, very difficult. So Chinese medicine uses a lot of extracts. And when I was at university, we were warned off the use of, or told to be very, very cautious of the use of Chinese herbal medicines because they could be dangerous and liver toxic because we couldn't standardize them. And so I think I would say some of it is fear of breaking out of that traditional model of evidence base that the NHS relies on when it's making prescribing recommendations. But I'd actually, it's interesting, because I haven't worked in secondary care for such a long time, I don't know what leeway oncologists have to be able to branch out beyond the NICE recommendations. I don't know what the kind of restrictions are on prescribing within hospitals for those sorts of things. Is there not you might know more, not a more possible approach there?
I don't know. I mean, to me, it's a very grey between what they're allowed to do and what they're prepared to do without being censured by their colleagues for doing it. So, it's a grey line that I don't really know the difference between the two, but the fact is they don't. Say the very idea that they might seems almost laughable. It's like, what, an oncologist with mushrooms? We don't do that here. That's how far it is away from their kind of radar. So, but it's a tragedy. They should be. They're absolutely brilliant with chemotherapy and things like that. They're just exactly the kind of thing patients need to get through those treatments they're being given and get through them much more successfully. So it's absolutely awful that huge weight of science is just completely ignored, whatever the reasoning is. And I think maybe you've given some of it, but, it's certainly not in our interest that this is happening. Far from it.
No, it is. It's very, very tragic. It needs, and the problem with the NHS is it's sort of, I always think of this as an immovable body. Takes such a long time. So I do a little bit of research and writing for the Doctor's Kitchen, and Rupi, who started the Doctor's Kitchen, is trying to drive nutrition and lifestyle education in medical schools. Yeah. So he's got into a couple of medical schools. There's a few leading lights that are really pushing it. Yeah. And he's also trying to drive, better eating habits within the country as well. So he's got lots of sort of fingers in lots of pies.
Yeah.
And I met him in 2018 on our first module. And I didn't even know who he was at the time. So I felt a bit stupid because all my sort of new colleagues, you know who he is? No idea who he was. This very good looking man that was sitting next to me. And so we had a chat and he asked me a little bit about my background. And he said, he told me what he was hoping to do. The following day I said, even though you're on the NHS entrepreneurship scheme, I think in order to achieve what you want to achieve, you need to circumvent the NHS. You need to come out, go around the side, and then come back in at the top. And I think that is the only way to actually drive the change. Trying to drive it whilst in it is very, very hard. That's just my opinion. I don't... You're just fighting against a culture that is so wedded to... And you made the point about sort of... there'll be some oncologists who are very wedded to this idea that it is drugs and perhaps only drugs. And, you know, the fact that when you're sort of hooked up to your chemo drip and the trolley comes in with a load of kind of ice buns and whatever, that's got no impact. There are lots of practices that sort of I find hard to kind of stomach. You also have, you know, we always were taught that you have this idea, you present a problem. So I would present with a problem to, say, a surgeon, and he would want to fix my problem by cutting me to pieces. You present me to another type of doctor and he would see it through his lens. And this is the problem. We're all kind of sort of in silos and there's no connected thinking, and I think that is the problem. That, I mean, there are lots of different issues, but I think that at its core it is the problem, this silo thinking rather than this holistic, broader thinking. And I've heard the term super generalist. I mean, it's really, really important to have a broad idea, and unfortunately we're not educated like that, and then we enter into a system that doesn't practice like that, and before we know it we're so narrow we're missing all of the beautiful, amazing things that the Eastern philosophies and the Eastern cultures have been using for donkey's years, and we're not using it, and it's nuts. Completely crazy.
Right. Okay, look, I'm going to sneak in one last one, which you can give a sort of snappy answer to. Is just a bit of looking forward, how you see things progressing from here, what you'd like to see happening in oncology in another 5 years' time.
Oh, gosh. Well, exactly sort of how I sort of started. I would like to see that within oncology provision, there is nutrition and lifestyle support as standard. It goes and it's personalised. It's not, this is, you know, one-to-one, sit down, in the same way you would sit down with your oncologist and talk about your treatment from his perspective or her perspective. You would be... with, as soon as you had that diagnosis, you would be with somebody that would support you through on a diet and lifestyle journey. Excellent. Because it's so important.
All right. Yeah. Well, that's what we'd like to see. That's what we have to push to happen.
Yes. Keep them across. Yeah, that would be lovely. And the same in general practice for anyone presenting with any of the chronic diseases that are basically weighing our country down. They're very Western sort of lifestyle and culture driven, and the support, I believe, should be within the GP surgery. It should be community-based and within the GP surgery.
Completely agree. And it's heartening that so many GPs are doing what you're doing, training in functional medicine. So
it's a big move, which is great.
Yeah, it is great. Yeah. Look, we have to leave it there. Been a really interesting talk, Charlotte. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been really nice to chat to you. I'm really impressed with what you're doing. I have, like you were saying earlier, a very good feel about where we're going. And I can now turn around to my family who said, what on earth are you doing? Retraining? You don't know where you're going, to say to them. I can now tell you that this is exactly why I needed to do this, because we are now seeing the change. And it's great. It's really, really,
congratulations.
Really,
okay, very good. Thank you very much, Charlotte.
Thank you very much. Yeah, you take care.
Bye-bye. Bye. Well, that was every bit as interesting as I thought it would be. If you're a professional listening and you'd like to dig into the concept of integration and what it has to offer, then you may have noticed that I mentioned Integrative Oncology UK 2021, the one-day event being put on by the BSIO, that's the British Society for Integrative Oncology, in partnership with Progressive Communications, the organisers of Your Life and Cancer. that's aimed squarely at oncology professionals of all disciplines. It's on the 15th of May and full details and tickets are available from integrativeoncologyuk.com. Great to have you join me today. Do make a point of listening again next week to the next Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye. Thank you.